The Guardian.
During April, The Guardian's podcasts are partnering with audible.co.uk. Audible has over 60,000 digital audiobooks and are offering Guardian podcast listeners one for free. Visit guardian.co.uk/audible to find out more.
Football Weekly Extra today. Champions League semis. Bliss for Bayern and Chelsea as they end the Spanish side's dreams. And we counter the knee-jerk criticism of John Terry. Not a racist, not that kind of player, and not going to be in the final. Meanwhile, Premier League, we count down to the weekend action and just another Mank Monday, the title showdown at the Etihad. All of that, plus other things too, in Football Weekly Extra. Well, clearly a vintage show today then, after a quite remarkable week of football. Quite a remarkable lineup here in the Football Weekly orbiting pod as well, with Jonathan Wilson.
Morning.
Good morning to you, Jonathan. Hey, it's Michael Cox.
Hello, good morning.
Of zonalmiking.net.
Thank you.
And Barry Glendenning.
Hi, I'm clearly here as, like, in the news, you know, the funny story at the end about a parrot that can ride a skateboard or something.
More of that later. But first, I have to say, we've already had lots of shock news today. For example, Jonathan Wilson, who's not just brainy about football, he does fruit as well. Actually, as I say that, it comes out a bit wrong. What I mean is, John, you got some important information about fruit.
Well, I'm shocked this is news to people, but don't put fruit in a bowl of bananas, because bananas give off a gas which causes them to ripen. So, I mean, Barry, I know, is sweating on his mandarin orange.
Me too.
He's left with his bananas. But you can't trust him. It's like, I don't know what it's like. It's like letting John Terry babysit your kids. That's what you've done.
My word. I've got bananas in a bowl as well. This all came about because Jonathan Wilson's saying he likes to buy bananas green and let them ripen. I said, how do you do that? He hangs them on a hook, people. He's got a dedicated banana ripening device, and he scoffed when I mentioned leaving them around in a bowl. It's like we've left the gas on.
Yeah, exactly. I can't relax
now,
knowing that my mandarin oranges and my kiwi fruit are at home dying.
Is there any other foodstuff related news that we should be aware of before we go any further?
Bananas are berry.
Bananas are a berry.
Yes.
How could a banana possibly be a berry?
Because a berry is multiple seeds within a single pod. So actually, strangely, a blackberry is not a berry, it's a drupe. But a blueberry's a berry. A raspberry's not. Words are confusing at times.
Aren't they? Aren't they? And they're all we have to give you, listeners. Anyway, now, speaking of words, let's have some about the extraordinary semi-finals this week in the Champions League. Hey, this just in, goals not all that overrated after all, Jonathan Wilson. Hey? Barcelona did all the work, all the fancy down play. Chelsea just scored some goals, and bingo, they're in the final.
Yeah, because Barcelona defended like idiots.
Right.
I mean, I think what we did see this week is what a nonsense the away goals rule is.
Oh.
I know Rafa Honigstein last week was saying it doesn't matter, but actually it had a massive influence over both games.
Mm.
That Chelsea, having nicked a goal from Barcelona going to sleep and letting Ramirez charge through and finish brilliantly, Chelsea could then sit back. I mean, they would have sat back anyway, but they could sit back knowing that they were going to win, even though the scores were level. So Barcelona had to keep attacking, which in the end opened up the space for the Torres goal. You then saw last night Real Madrid score, make it 1-0, so they're ahead on away goals. So Bayern then lose all kinds of all shape, kind of trying to find a goal to, even though the score's level, they have to score. They leave themselves open, they don't defend very well. Cristiano Ronaldo scores again. Bayern then, you know, keep attacking, score, at which both sides think, oh, hang on, we'll stop. Because Bayern, they've got parity in the Bernabeu, they're scared to kind of go on and you know, try and win the game, quite logically, as any team would be. But Real Madrid are also fearful, because they think, Christ, if we let one in, not only are we one behind, we're actually effectively one and a half behind. We have to score two so as not to lose. And that makes a nonsense of it.
Didn't it make quite an exciting game as well?
Not after half-time, it didn't.
No, that's true. Michael, what do you think? He says get rid of away goals.
Yeah, there's a good piece in one of the Blizzards about that, actually.
Ian Hawkey wrote a piece. I mean, I think the point Hawkey made, and actually, this is what confused me about what Ralph Hollingshead was saying last week.
Everyone was a bit confused, including Rafa.
His evidence, the evidence he produced, was very, very sane and very rational.
Yeah.
But he seemed to draw completely the wrong conclusion from it. Because this point that in you know, 20 or 30 years ago, in fact, I did some research on this. Well, I read the Blizzard piece, in fairness. I didn't actually do research. But when the away goals was introduced in 1965 in the Cup Winners' Cup, only 16% of away games in European competition ended in an away win. Now that figure, if you look at the last five seasons, is between 30 and 35. And that's partly because travel is much easier, so your away team doesn't arrive disoriented and exhausted. There's much more homogeneity of conditions, so you know, pitch sizes are more similar, pitch conditions are more similar. There's, you know, things are just controlled a lot more, so you're not going into as hostile an environment as you would have been 30 or 40 years ago. Also, you know, for Bayern Munich to go to Madrid, a lot of those players have played in Madrid before. It's not something new, not something totally different, not something shocking. You've sort of got this Western and Northern European cabal of teams who dominate European competition and play each other over and over again. So those teams playing each other, there's not such a sense of being in an alien place.
Mm.
So yeah, it's easier to play as you're waiting, which is exactly what Rafael was saying.
Mm.
But I think that then means that there's no need for the away goals rule, and it unbalances games in a way that, you know, previously it was quite common for the home team to win 3-0 or 3-1 or 4-1, and quite common for that to be overturned. I mean, Partizan in 66 got beaten 4-1 in Sparta Prague in the quarterfinal, went to Belgrade and won 5-0. That wasn't unusual. So what the away goal rule was there for was to stop away teams going, thinking, OK, we're right. bedding, we'll lose 2-0. It was to get them to say, actually, 3-1 is better than 2-0. Whereas now, I just think it's outmoded and it spoils football.
OK, I'll just stop you there because we're about 8 minutes in. We've done bananas, but we haven't done well done to Chelsea yet. And that means we'll be in big trouble with Chelsea supporters out there.
Absolutely. I mean, they rode their luck to an extent. I mean, Messi missed a penalty and, you know, they hit the post as well. But they did absolutely everything they could do. And you've got to admire their discipline, you've got to admire their work rate and admire their shape, and they frustrated Barcelona.
People said they wouldn't be able to go to Barcelona and get the result. Not only did they do it, they did it without John Terry and Gary Cahill at the back, and of course David Luiz, you might consider that a factor, or not. So in that sense, it was a remarkable night.
Yeah, I thought they defended brilliantly. I think in a way it wasn't such a bad thing that they had Bossinger at centre-back, because against Barcelona you don't need a really tall, powerful, traditional centre-back. You do need someone who's mobile, who can track players, who can pick up runs. And I think Bossinger did that really well. And Ana Ivanovic as well. I must say, I wasn't really convinced by Ivanovic a couple of years ago. I thought he was a bit ponderous on the ball. But he's become a very good right-back. He's developed a strange knack of crossing with the outside of his right foot a couple of times, which has worked really well. And a very competent centre-back as well.
Hmm. Barcelona tickled a bit, didn't they? Do you think, Barry, they didn't seem, for all the possession they had, and we saw this a little bit with the Clasico, there weren't, although we say Chelsea defended brilliantly, there were no moments of good lord, what an extraordinary last-ditch tackle, or what a brilliant save by Petr Cech. It was mainly just pass, 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 interrupt, pass, 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 interrupt.
I think there was a couple of good saves by Petr Cech, and Barcelona should have won the tie comfortably if they'd taken the chances they had, while not wanting to take anything away from Chelsea's two heroic performances. They did ride their luck a lot. They were lucky. That's been a hallmark of Roberto Di Matteo's stewardship so far. I think he's a lucky general, and there's nothing wrong with that. But Chelsea have come in for quite a lot of criticism for their negative tactics, which I think is kind of unfair, because what else are you supposed to do against Barcelona? But there's sort of an image of the plucky little underdog church mice, if that's not mixing animal metaphors, but, which I think is ridiculous considering the amount of money that's been spent. Interestingly, Roman Abramovich wasn't at the Nou Camp to see the game, and while no doubt he's delighted they're in the final, when he bought Chelsea, it wasn't with the intention of having this incredibly defensive team, you know, setting out such a negative stall against Barcelona. And if every team played like Chelsea did against Barcelona, we wouldn't be sitting here discussing it, because no one would be interested in football.
That's possible. Just on the subject of Di Matteo, I remember when he came in, we were a little bit sneery, perhaps even snide, about him, his standing with the players. Was it actually John Terry who's going to be doing all the managing anyway? I think perhaps we do need to doff. I need to doff my hat. So tactically, is there something that he's brought? Lampard says he's made everybody feel good again, and that's half the battle. But is there something he's done to the team that just has put everything in the right, all the pieces in the right place?
Well, he has played a completely different way in the league to the way he played against Barcelona. Right. Against Barcelona, he was playing with three very deep holding midfielders. In the league, he's been playing with two. And in the FA Cup, he's been playing with two, with a kind of a traditional number 10 higher up the pitch. So I'm not sure you can look at his whole tenure so far and say that he's played a specific way. I think you've got to give him credit for the fact that he did vary his tactics and did play a different way against Barcelona.
Right, well, he's got a bit of a conundrum on his hand as he heads into the final then, with all these players, not only John Terry and Ivanovic, we can come on to those in a second perhaps, but arguably the man who's been their player of the knockout stage is Ramirez.
I think Ramirez and Ivanovic have both been excellent all season. I mean, I think the point Michael makes about Ivanovic looking ponderous at right back, I mean, he was a centre back when he arrived and he was sort of forced out to right back, and I think he's been bright enough to adapt to that position. But I mean, I think he's just a very, very good defender. Ramirez has been excellent all season. I think those two have probably been their best two players this season. So something I was going to say about the criticism of Chelsea and this use of the term anti-football, which for me, anti-football is cheating. It's time wasting. It's feigning injury. It's tactical fouling. And you can argue Chelsea got to some of that in the first leg. I mean, Drogba was flinging himself down and clearly destroying the rhythm of the game. The second leg, there was very, very little of that. I mean, Cech maybe took a little bit of more time than he should have done over goal kicks, but got booked for it and then stopped. And this, that was the really impressive thing about the display. It was very, very good defending without going into the cheating side of things.
Right, okay. Apart from John Terry kneeing his opponent up the bum.
But that's stupidity rather than cheating.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And has it had its precedent 29 years earlier?
Oh, right. In what way, Jonathan?
In that Leeds, who had begun the season with an ageing squad, with an upstart manager who'd come in to try and change things. He'd got rid of that upstart manager.
They
brought in a safe pair of hands. Leeds then struggle away to the semi-final of the European Cup. They play Barcelona. They have a man sent off, Gordon McQueen. If you read David Lacey's report from the day following the game, there's so many phrases from that report that could have been used on Wednesday morning about losses of discipline, about Barcelona being muted, about not taking the world by storm as everybody expected.
Gordon McQueen not being that sort of player.
I'm sure that's how he saw it, certainly. Right. And so with 10 men, Leeds hold out, wearing white in the Camp Nou, on April 24th for a 3-2 aggregate victory over Barcelona. Go on to the final where they play Bayern Munich.
No.
Yes. We're cheated out of it disgracefully by some awful refereeing. I mean, refereeing so awful that I cannot believe it wasn't fixed.
Sean Ingle want me to ask, what was the score?
2-0.
2-0, Sean.
In the final, 2-0.
Wow, that's amazing. And that was 29 years ago to the day.
But I mean, I think what's worrying for Chelsea is actually, I mean, those are all quirky coincidences.
You should write a piece on that.
I have, and you'll be able to read it, assuming it gets through the subs. It'll be on the Guardian website later on this morning.
Right.
Or actually in the past by the time you listen to this, I guess.
I don't know.
Time's difficult, isn't it? It's like words, confusing.
Yep.
The underlying issues, which are an ageing core of players that need rejuvenation. What happened with Leeds was they finished fifth a couple of times in the seasons that followed, but never got above that, basically bobbed around mid-table. In the end, turned to the players to be managers. So you had Alan Clark, led them to relegation in 82, then Eddie Gray, then Billy Bremner, which perhaps is a warning not to give a job to John Terry. But right. I think what I'm saying is that Chelsea shouldn't let reaching the Champions League final disguise the fact this is an ageing squad that does need rejuvenation.
All right, okay. Can I just get back onto Ivanovic?
Yes.
Because a lot of sympathy for him, particularly the way he discovered he wouldn't be in the final and the Jeff Shreves interview and all that. But it's worth noting, as indeed some listeners have done, his explanation for how he got booked in the first place. He was scuffing up the penalty spot to try and basically undermine Leo Messi's chances of a fair kick at goal.
Yeah, I remember Fernando Torres doing that a few years ago, so maybe that's something Torres has brought to Chelsea, rubbed off on Ivanovic.
Perhaps so.
And he clearly did a fine job.
He clearly did do it. Well worth his yellow card. Torres, though, eh?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I don't think Torres was doing particularly well, and I think he was only in the position he was because he was meant to be playing on the left of midfield, as Drogba had done, and they weren't playing any striker. He was only really in the position he was because he'd miscontrolled a dribble and got tackled, and Barcelona literally didn't have any defenders. But he took the finish brilliantly because for a player under a lot of pressure, lacking confidence, he had a lot of time to mess that up. And he
if you compare it to Andy Carroll in the Newcastle-Liverpool game, it was almost identical, no? Two strikers, both with a massive amount of pressure, big price tags, very few goals, through just with the keeper to beat. They're both round the keeper. Carroll decides, I think what I'll do is fall over here, whereas Torres, redemption.
Yeah, and Darrow Breen mentioned on Twitter yesterday that it was sort of identical to when Nicholas Bentner was presented with a glorious opportunity to knock Barcelona out of the Champions League. Was it last year or the year before? But similar circumstances, they were down to 10 men. Bentner had his opportunity and blew it, but Torres scored his.
All right. Well, Jonathan, you say getting to the final shouldn't disguise problems for Chelsea, etc. What should Barcelona draw from all of this? What Bagley, for example, says, Wilson and Cox, how long will Barca remain as strong as they are now? Is a rebuilding of the Barcelona team necessary in the next year? Formica Atomic are equally asking, is Messi having a stinker or are Chelsea making him look bad, that are written during the game?
There's two issues there. Firstly, with Messi, teams seem to have worked out how to play against a false nine. That the second leg against Chelsea, he didn't play as a false nine, but the first leg and the game against Real Madrid, he did.
Just in case there's any listeners out there who are too embarrassed to ask, I'll do it for them. What exactly would you define as the false nine?
False nine is a player who plays as the centre forward, but drops deep towards midfield, right, sort of leaving a space ahead of him. So it's not a 10 who would play in the same area, but would have a centre forward ahead of him. It's the player who comes back from centre forward's position to effectively play as an attacking midfielder, leaving space. Both Chelsea in the first leg and Real Madrid on Saturday packed that area in front of their back forward players, and then Messi gets the ball and he's suddenly got four players in front of him. And there's not much he can do. And I think to possibly Barcelona miss Villa and Pedro, who were very good at starting wide and cutting into that space and giving him options. And we saw on Saturday that when Alexis Sanchez came on and played ahead of Messi, suddenly Messi looked a more dangerous player because he had that player taking defenders away, creating space for him, giving him a passing option. So maybe Barcelona have suffered from those injuries to Villa and Pedro. I could understand why Sanchez played from the start in the second leg against Chelsea. That's one issue. I mean, to be fair to Messi, he's been consistently brilliant for 3 years, and he has a slight blip in over a period of three games. I mean, I don't think we should slaughter him for that.
No. But it was just interesting that over those two games, he did look frustrated.
He looked like he does when he plays for Argentina, and yeah. I guess maybe the penalty miss stems from that. That's sort of the anxiety, the tension that brings.
So Barcelona do need to go about some form of rebuilding, in that they do need to have a deeper selection, do they, of forward options?
Well, I think one of their problems is that Guardiola, I think, is very aware of the need to evolve. I think possibly more than any other coach in history, he's got this consciousness, and maybe because he is so Barcelona centric, you know, he's not thinking of his next job, he's thinking of how to make Barcelona good in the future. So whereas I'm sure Mourinho was just sort of, let's get him as good as I can this season, maybe next, and then I'll get another job somewhere else. I don't think Guardiola has any of that kind of mentality. There's very little chance of him leaving Barcelona going straight into another big job. I think if he leaves Barcelona, he'll just have a rest. So it's a very different approach. And historically, there is this trend that great teams, after 3 years, tend to fade, whether that's a lack of hunger, whether it's just players starting to age, whether it's teams working them out. And maybe Barcelona going through some of that. But Guardiola has tried to bring in players every summer to slightly change the style. And really, I'm not sure any of them, with the exception of Villa, has worked particularly well. Ibrahimovic was brought in to give him the option of height. And yeah, they really could have done with that against Chelsea, because Chelsea could give them corners and know they weren't a threat. So if you were playing into a normal side, you think, well, we don't want to give them a corner because eventually if they put in enough crosses, they're going to find somebody's head. But Barcelona aiming at Puyol all the time. They haven't got anybody else who's going to win a header. And Puyol's only 5'10" and a half, I think. You know, he's not a massive player. So you could see why Ibrahimovic was brought in, but personality-wise, it didn't work. I'm not sure Fabregas has really helped the balance of the midfield. I think Iniesta has had a poor season, possibly as a result. Sanchez, okay, he's done okay without setting the world on fire, and yeah, he's been hampered by injury as well. So this constant tinkering Guardiola's is applied to the side. You change from a back four to a back three. In some cases, it's worked. I mean, the switch to back three really worked against Real Madrid back in November. But I think also possibly he's overdone it, and it's affected the rhythm of the side.
No, all right then, Barry.
Is it facile to say Barcelona don't have a plan B, and if, because they sort of clearly don't, in my opinion anyway, I could be wrong, and if that's the case, are they victims of their own success in that they haven't really needed one?
Yes. I mean, their plan A is so exceptionally good, why would you need a plan B? But I mean, that's why Ibrahimovic was brought in, was to give him a plan B.
Michael?
I think that's a good point about Ibrahimovic. I mean, I think the problem with him was that they needed a tool central striker to be the plan B. We know Ibrahimovic, his attitude, the fact that he cost £50 million. You can't really just use that player as a last 10 minutes player. Mm. You know, he almost demands to be in the side, or he probably literally does demand to be in the side. And therefore, I think that if you look at what Manchester United have got with Berbatov, he's almost the perfect person in that style. He's maybe not a physical aerial player, but he's an option from the bench that doesn't seem to mind being on the bench, and I think that's really crucial. And I think Guardiola's problems with Ibrahimovic maybe kind of covered the fact that actually they do need a player in that style, just not with that attitude.
All right, well, that's a question for... Sorry, Barry.
Maybe they should actually sign Plan B and then just bring on a lounge room crooner in a sharp suit. That would throw the opposition.
Certainly would. I mean, a very telling contribution there, Barry. On that bombshell, Jonathan, have you got...
Well, on this issue of a tall forward, of course, against Inter in 2010 in the semi-final, they moved Piqué up front to give him that aerial option, but Piqué had been knocked out by Victor Valdez.
Yeah. He didn't even know he played in the game, poor chap.
And funnily enough, last point, in that game they got it wrong because they started with Ibrahimovic and then took him off for, I think, Bojan or Pedro or someone. And then when Inter dropped deep, they suddenly realised, oh, we've got it wrong. We should have started with the small, quick players and then brought on the tool number nine.
Yeah. Oh, well, as I say, that brings us to the end of part one. Of course, Chelsea now have to face the big one, QPR, at the weekend. And then after that, Bayern Munich, who knocked out Real Madrid last night. In a second or two, we'll dial up Sidlow to hear what the Spanish have made of this total collapse of the Liga giants in the Champions League. Part two, then, and let's dial up, fresh from the Bernabeu, Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you, and how is the mood in Madrid?
Well, as you can imagine, the mood in Madrid is largely pretty down. It was interesting last night that Real Madrid's fans did something that Barcelona had done the night before, which was at the final whistle, they gave their side a huge ovation. I think it was a sense that you know, going out on penalties in the semi-final isn't a disgrace. Of course, that then gives way to some analysis, some of the relatively small criticism, because ultimately a team that reaches a semi-final and goes out of penalties deserves some credit, no matter what's happened. But one or two little things that have been picked up on. But more than anything else is that kind of sense of, hang on a minute, 3 days ago we thought we were having a Spanish final, and now it's not going to happen. One or the other.
Because of the cowardly anti-football Chelsea, I think I read somewhere.
Probably. I must confess I didn't see that exact line, but you almost certainly would have read that somewhere, because certainly the reaction from some, not all of it, but from some parts of Spanish media was that Chelsea had played a kind of anti-football, I suppose, to some extent, given the conceptualisation of football here. That's sort of understandable. If you don't necessarily share it, you can understand where that mindset comes from. The other thing, of course, in all of this, the slightly bizarre situation is, I think we've said lots of times this year that it sometimes feels like Cristiano Ronaldo and Messi ring each other up before the weekend. How many goals should we get this weekend? Then two? Yeah, okay, then two, because they seem to match each other stride for stride, and unfortunately, of course, they've just matched each other for penalties as well.
Yeah, although Ronaldo did put his away during the game. We had a quick... The notion in Barcelona seems to be that rather than wholesale changes, they need to get Pep signed to a new deal. Is that right?
Yeah, I think, and this is one of the most significant changes. Barcelona, over the course of their history, have been a club where fatalism takes hold quite easily, and generally speaking, they've made big mistakes. I think when things have gone wrong, there's been almost a kind of a desperation to get results, which of course actually ends up sometimes preventing you from getting results. Whereas I think certainly with the arrival of Jurgen Klopp as coach, but even more so with Guardiola, because even after Cruyff there were moments of huge instability. Stability now, a sense that they know what it is they're trying to achieve. They have an idea and an identity that's very clear. And that this is a coach that, more than anything else, they want him to continue. It doesn't matter that Guardiola's made mistakes, and of course he has made some mistakes as well as done some great stuff for them. They want him to continue. I must admit, though, I think they're going to be disappointed.
All right. Well, listen, the finale there at the Bernabeu yesterday, the penalty shootout, must have been a pretty intense experience to live through. What was it like for you, Sid? And do you think Chelsea got the better or worse opponent for the final?
It's interesting. What was it like? That's exactly the question I asked Mourinho last night. That he was talking about the pressure. I think he's quite right, by the way. He was saying that, he got quite sort of chippy about it, Mourinho. He was saying, you know, people are saying, why has so-and-so missed a penalty? How can he miss a penalty? Well, the best players miss penalties. And it was interesting because for about the first time last night, I think we saw a Mourinho discourse in which he almost grabbed hold of Barcelona and kind of put them in his argument. So he was talking about, you know, both clubs had suffered that. He used Messi's penalty miss as an explanation for Ronaldo's penalty miss. He was talking about best players miss penalty. And he said, and this is where I say, I think, right, he made a point of saying, I think sometimes people don't realise the absolutely brutal pressure that sometimes players are under, and that kind of situation is a really, really difficult one to live through. So then I said to him, look, you talk about the pressure of the players, what's it like for a coach in that situation when, you know, you can't do anything anymore? I mean, during the game, obviously a coach's power to change things is relatively limited because it's the players that are on the pitch, but in a penalty shootout, there's nothing a coach can do once it starts. And he was saying that it's actually quite... You suffer because you sit there and you think they're out there. They're all terrified. They're trying to take penalties in a situation where there's so much at stake. And there was tension more than anything else. I suppose it was a strange one though because Madrid missed the first two. You sort of very quickly thought, that's it, Bayern have won it. And then when Casillas made the saves, you think, oh, hang on, this could go the other way. And as for what it was like for me, well, writing a match report in a situation like that is entertaining to say the least.
Shadowy Uber producer Matt Hall wants you all to know that after the roaring success, it says here, of what we did at the Emirates last year for the Champions League final, we're going to be doing something this year again on the night of the final, says Shadowy Uber producer Matt Hall. We can't reveal too much yet, but we promise at least one working TV and more bar staff. This could be important changes to the scenario everyone underwent last year, Barry Glendinning.
Yeah.
Certainly would. Now, shall we move on to the Premier League then? I mentioned that Chelsea are going to be playing QPR. Of course, QPR caught up in that big relegation battle. You've got the extremely exciting top four race, or should I say now top three race, because it becomes more and more possible, this notion of Chelsea winning the Champions League and thus denying whoever finishes fourth their entrance into the Champions League preliminaries. Jonathan, you're glazing over at this. But anyway, you'd probably like to start with a big, big game on Monday, wouldn't you? Man City, Man United, hey?
Yeah.
What do you think, eh? We've had a 6-1 City winning there at Old Trafford. We've had a 3-2 in the FA Cup, United winning there at the Etihad. What kind of numbers do you think we're going to be seeing on Monday?
0-0.
Really?
No, I don't know. I mean, it's the both teams are so unpredictable this season, it's very hard to tell. I mean, the fact that United lost 6-1 at home to City... In 1908, given we're doing precedence,
yes.
Sunderland won 9-1 at Newcastle. He then went on to win the league.
Oh.
So it's the biggest ever away win in the top flight in England, and yet the team who were on the receiving end still won the title that year. So it has happened before that a team's got absolutely caned at home and has gone on to win the title.
There is this notion that City can win this game, but are still unlikely to actually take the title because of the games they've got coming up afterwards. Man United will be at home to Swansea and then at Sunderland, which for some reason people are saying is going to be an easy game. I'm not sure about that. Man City are at home to Newcastle, who seem to be involved in everybody's running, and then at home to QPR.
Well, Sunderland have switched off, haven't they? I mean, Sunderland had four of the last five games have failed to score. I mean, they were dreadful at Everton, dreadful at home to Villa. Dreadful at Villa, dreadful at home to Wolves. I don't think Sunderland will score.
That's why they're saying...
Well, I think it's entirely possible Sunderland won't score again this season. And the great thing is, it doesn't matter, because we're already safe.
All right, then. So, Man United do have an easier run-in, yes?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think it'll be a really interesting game, actually. I mean, City obviously have got to win, and I think it suits their styles. United are quite patient in the centre of the pitch with Scholes and Carrick. They're quite kind of quiet, almost timid players, whereas City are much more powerful with Yaya Toure bombing forward. And he was the man who won it last year in the semi-final at Wembley by intercepting a pass between Carrick and Scholes, which kind of sums up the difference in styles. So I'm really looking forward to this game. I think it's one of the biggest games I can remember in the Premier League.
Well, the strange thing is that last season, Chelsea went to Manchester United 3 points behind in the third last game of the season. So, OK, the home and away polarities are flipped. But actually, I think we don't remember that particularly because United won 2-1 and so it's only 6 points clear and the titles race is over.
But in derby terms, I mean, Sir Alex Ferguson the derby thing, the biggest ever, and you know, memories of 67-68, a Man City beating Man United in a derby just before taking the title.
And that season, United went to Sunderland on the last day of the season and lost.
Right. Tell you what does it all mean? I don't know.
There's a limited number of teams in football, and occasionally they play each other at similar times of the season.
Right. Oh, you're romantic. Okay. Well, of course, City so strong down the middle. United with those amazing wingers, the Nannies, the Valencias, the Youngs, etc. Interesting clash of styles. Aguero and Tevez up front for one lot. Who? Welbeck and Rooney for the other? Barry, you're excited by this.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be an awful big palaver in the build-up and sort of bland platitudes uttered at pre-match press conferences will be twisted totally out of shape, and there'll be chat about mind games, which is complete bollocks. And hopefully the game will actually be good. But these things that we build ourselves up to into a frenzy of excitement, that games tend to pan out into dab squibs, although no doubt Johnson will be able to cite examples from the last 200 years of games that did live up to the hype.
What is almost entirely without precedent is the fact that we're actually moving Monday's Football Weekly to Tuesday to accommodate this Monday night match. The first
time that's happened since
2 weeks ago when we did it because there were a whole lot of games on Monday. Sorry, Barry.
I'm against this, fundamentally against this. Whenever we move a pod for some special occasion, it always ends up being a disaster.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well,
like this morning when we moved it about 8 hours earlier than usual to accommodate some diva's demands.
Yep.
Yeah. If we sound cranky and under the weather, it's because we're actually recording this at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yep, absolutely.
You're doing, Jimbo, that's so important?
I've already used my milk crown gag, but okay, good. Well, I tell you what, let's move. No, Jonathan.
In terms of quasi-titled deciders right near the end of the season, I called it a decider on Twitter and got hammered for it. Don't nick my notes, Barry. I need them for this.
No, I just wanted to see what they're written on. Executive club notepaper.
Yeah, what is that executive club notepaper?
Sounds like some sort of gentleman's club where women parade around rabbit's ears with tails.
Sadly not. This was a free notepad from a hotel in... Actually, not merely a hotel in Bogota, the Tequendama Hotel in Bogota, which is where Bobby Moore got nicked.
Oh, okay.
So you decided to nick their stationery as an homage.
That's for you, Bobby.
Revenge is a dish served very, very cold in this instance.
So I went through every season of league history to find out when there'd been a similar decider. It's not quite a decider. Obviously 1989... when Arsenal went to Liverpool and won 2-0 the very final game. So that's one example. But in 1999, Villa played Liverpool on the final day. Sides level.
1899?
Yeah, sides level at the top of the table.
Right.
And Villa were 5-0 up inside half an hour. Right. And so won the title.
In 1984, nobody died.
And the only other, I mean, I suppose there's two other vaguely comparable ones, or that you could say were more exciting than that. So 1947, Liverpool won 2-1 at Leeds, which ended up winning them the title. They didn't find out for another 2 weeks because it'd been a very bad winter, so there'd been a lot of postponements. So they had to wait for Stoke to play Sheffield United. And that night, Liverpool played Everton at Anfield in a Liverpool Senior Cup game.
Mm-hmm.
And over the tannoy, they kept broadcasting the score from Bramall Lane. And Sheffield United won 2-1.
Oh, there you go.
Or... 1972, when Derby beat Liverpool on their final day, but again, they had to wait for Leeds to fail to beat Wolves and for Liverpool to fail to beat Arsenal.
Right, OK. Well, once again, it could be one of those ones where you win and then you wait 2 weeks to see what happens because of those games in the run-in. I think that was the point we were making. I'm going to move on now to, what, race for not being in the bottom three or the race for being in the top three? Race for not being in the bottom three?
Well, yeah, there was a big game in midweek.
Absolutely.
With Bolton winning 2-1 at Aston Villa.
So Aston Villa are now in that relegation scrap.
Yeah, definitely. And to be honest, I think they've almost done well to keep out of it until now. I think they've been a really bad side all year. I think they've been lucky there's been five pretty bad teams in the Premier League this season. But, I mean, McLeish has absolutely no support from the fans, I think for three reasons. One, because he's got a track record of leading sides to relegation, if that's a bit harsh, considering he won the Cullen Cup as well. Two, because the style of football is just dreadful. It's so defensive. One striker up front and long balls towards him. They had a 56% pass completion rate against Bolton, which I know is kind of a geeky stat, but considering you could lob the ball in the middle of the pitch and probably get 50-50, that's quite bad, really, 56%. And the third reason, obviously, is that McLeish came from Birmingham.
Right.
But I think that the other two reasons have kind of superseded that now.
Well, they'll be facing the other Birmingham team this weekend when they have the derby with West Brom. They're 3 points above Bolton, who are in the bottom three, but Bolton have a game in hand. They're at Sunderland, which, Jonathan, you were just explaining, they shouldn't worry too much. It's kind of flip-flops on and recliners out and all that at the stadium over light. Meanwhile, QPR are at Chelsea, who have a bundle of players missing through injury, suspension, etc., and their minds elsewhere, you'd figure at the moment, no, Chelsea?
Yeah, and as I recall, Milan only drew their next league game after they'd faced Barcelona. I think just the concentration and all the running Chelsea's players had to do will have knackered them. Their eyes are obviously going to be on the big prize, and yeah, QPR will fancy their chances.
All right, the big prize. Because big prizes, because they're playing Liverpool in the FA Cup final. There you go. Now, Sunderland taking on Bolton. Spurs taking on Blackburn. Interesting game, this one. Spurs, one win in nine. Here's Mr. Gareth E. Saying, it's worth pointing out that in the same number of league games since Terry Connor took over at Wolves and has got pilloried for taking 2 points, Spurs' manager has only mustered three.
Well, I think it's unfair to say Terry Connor has been pilloried, because I don't think he has.
Oh.
He's been pitied rather than pilloried.
Yeah, pitied, right. Which is probably worse.
Patronised,
yep. Pitied. He was clearly out of his depth, not sure if he even wanted the job.
I'm not sure he's even out of his depth. I mean, he is a sinking ship. Do something with it. what do you do? I mean, just get in the lifeboat, lads, get away.
Yeah, I suppose. Well, yeah, Harry Redknapp's record since beating Newcastle after the end of his court case has been awful, absolutely terrible. And I don't know why. I don't know what's going on at White Hart Lane, but there's not really much you can analyse about it except to say that he's been terrible.
Well, they had a very odd January, didn't they? I think letting Pienaar go, in retrospect, was a dreadful mistake. I mean, he's been really good for Everton, and I think Spurs could really do with an extra midfielder just to sort of ease the burden on the players.
Especially someone who plays out knackered. Wide. No?
Well, I mean, Pienaar is versatile as well. You can play him wide, you can play him as a creative player through the middle as well.
Harry didn't really play him at all, did he?
No, just he didn't. He's just one of those players he didn't fancy, yeah.
But why buy him then? That's what.
Well, he was cheap, wasn't he? He was like $2 million or something. It's a weirdly dealer thing, isn't it? Yeah. And I don't think Saha's injured.
Yeah.
Did anybody see that coming?
No. Absolutely not. So there they are. They're 3 points behind Newcastle, 6 points behind Arsenal, who currently lie third, but they do have a game in hand on the Gunners. And they are at home to a Rovers side who are 19th, 1 point behind Bolton, who, of course, have a game in hand on them. Rovers, are they the next to go? Then they've got this, and then they've got Wigan at home, then they're at Chelsea. It's a tough set of final fixtures, isn't it, for Blackburn?
Well, I think that win over Norwich last week was absolutely crucial for them, wasn't it? I mean, if they hadn't got the win there, I think you'd have said, yeah, that's all over. I guess they would think, well, maybe they can get something at Spurs, because Spurs are in such bad form. And then Wigan at home, that clearly is the crucial game. I just wonder whether Wigan's sort of run of form, whether losing at Fulham is at the end of it, or is it just a blip?
Right. Well, we're going to have Newcastle United this weekend. It's a tough game.
It's very tough. Yeah.
Very tough. And what about Arsenal up there in third place, but they're at Stoke. Arteta's out. Walcott's out.
Yeah, Arteta's been fantastic this year. They haven't won a game in the Premier League when Arteta hasn't started, which I think is a great stat. I think Arsenal have almost got to a strange point where they feel as if they've got third place sewn up, but they haven't yet. They do need probably one more win. So it'd be interesting to see if they can get it.
Cool.
I was actually in Stoke on a wet Monday night this week.
All right, what happened?
Nothing. Just train pulled in, pulled out again.
That's a great story, Barry. All right.
But I felt I would have been able to perform had I been called upon to do anything in particular.
Well, that's good to know. That brings us to the end of part two. Coming up in a second, some of your questions to Michael, Barry and Jonathan.
There's no questions for me.
There's none for me either. No. But it's the other two. And, ooh, look, bit of Italy. Part three. Almost there, Jonathan. Almost there. Need you at your sharpest for this. Guru Post Corner. Right. You and Michael here, and of course Barry as well. So a lot of people sending in lots of tactical questions, which confused me, I have to say. There were very few that I understood.
Rattle a few of them out there, Jimbo,
I will sort them out. All right, good. In your opinion, Barry, who's the most tactically astute footballer you've seen, and what's the best tactical battle you've seen between two coaches in one single game?
Michael?
I always think of the Barcelona-Inter game over two legs in 2010. I know it was very similar to the Chelsea game, but I always thought that was very interesting.
Right.
The Mourinho-Guardiola rivalry, when it's not kind of bitchy and petty, I think is really good because I think they're two excellent managers. And the thing that people forget about that sometimes is that Inter really attack Barcelona at home and won 3-1 fair and square, not playing Barcelona at their own game, but really attacking. So that was a great game. The question about the player, I'm not sure. Maybe Redondo was very good, could play quite deep in midfield, but could be quite forward-thinking and also then could switch to conserving the ball. So I always thought he was very useful.
That's interesting. Well, Wayne Rooney's another player who can shift around and play in all sorts of positions. I know he's not a player that you necessarily normally think, wow, he's a big brain on two legs, but he, in football terms, he certainly offers a wealth of tactical options.
Andriy Shevchenko said that Rooney is the closest player he sees now to what he became under Lobanovsky. Lobanovsky's ideal of a universal player. He said for him, Rooney is the only player in modern football who Lobanovsky would like.
Would.
Right, that's taking it too far. Who Lobanovsky would see as being approaching this ideal.
Would, by the same token, Steven Gerrard be perhaps the most tactically inastute, if that's even a word, player?
Well, is that great line from Sacchi, isn't it? That he said, you know, some players you see have all the skills, but they just can't play football. And so I said to him, "Are you think of anybody in particular?" And he sort of smiled. I went, "Gerrard," and he just sort of smiled and nodded, but without actually saying yes. But it was clear that
right there was a moment
that was in the forefront of his mind. In terms of best tactical battle, I think maybe the 2003 Champions League final, which was Ancelotti's Milan. Who was the coach? It was Lippi's.
Wasn't it? Yeah, it was, wasn't it?
Yeah,
Lippi's.
I mean, that was fascinating. Every substitution was followed 5 minutes later by an opposing substitution to cancel it out.
Right, no, producer Ben, it wasn't the most boring game.
I honestly don't understand. That wasn't Catenaccio. People say that was Catenaccio. It's nonsense. Nothing like Catenaccio. It's
more
a
like
very, very good tactical
trench
battle.
Warfare from the 19. Yeah,
no, okay. It wasn't, because it wasn't two teams sat on the edge of their own box firing mortars at each other. To
right.
Carry on that metaphor misleadingly.
Yeah.
It was like a game of chess. Not that I understand chess, but that's what I think chess ought to be like.
Okay. If Barcelona played Swansea, would it be the best or most boring game in history?
I think Barcelona might win that.
Right. But would it be a good game, do you think? That'd be terrific, wouldn't it?
Well, I mean, yeah, but two teams playing a very similar style. And, personally, I'd prefer to see a contrast of styles. But, yeah, it'd be interesting to see it. I'd hate it if all teams played like that.
Right. Speaking of contrasts of styles, Michael, I know this is something you've written about. The way that a lot of the leagues around Europe this season have got a team of plucky battlers against a team of superior talent. That might be stretching it to say that about Man United and Man City. But
no, I think that's fair, actually.
You've got Montpellier, PSG, Man City, Man United, Dortmund, Bayern, arguably. Certainly Juventus, Milan has been depicted in that light in Italy.
No, I think it's fair, and I think it does apply very much to England, because I think on paper you look at the starting 11s. I think Manchester City are a much better team than Manchester United. They've got Silva, Nasri, Aguero. Individually, they are superior. The thing they don't have is what Manchester United clearly do have, which is a collective team spirit and very good discipline. And I think that certainly applies in France, where I think it would be miraculous if Montpellier overcome PSG after how much money they've spent. And I must say, I'm quite pleased in Italy. I think Juventus are a much better team than Milan, who are just all about force and strength and power. I think Juventus are technically a much better team, and Conte's done a wonderful job.
One final tactical question for now. Wonk says, given the high number of outlandish scores this year, the obvious effects of fatigue on certain squads and other teams' over-reliance on single players, is it time to declare the death of tactics in the Premiership?
You can't.
How does that follow?
Call it dead.
That doesn't really follow, does it, from the...
Well, he's saying it's a bit of a lottery, I think.
Given bananas cause fruit to ripen, is it time to declare the revolution's over in Sri Lanka? Just two things that have nothing to do with each other. What's that? I don't understand what he's talking about.
Well, but there's one question I posted on Twitter for Michael a couple of weeks ago that he either ignored or didn't see. I think it was quite late at night. But
it probably confused him. He was running scared.
Yeah. That could be it.
His words are confusing.
They are. And time.
Yeah. And bananas.
And bananas.
Yeah. Anyway, your question to Michael.
Well, my question was, and it applies to both our guests here, is that how much of your analysis, tactical analysis, depends on a result? Because there could just be a lick of paint in the outcome. You know, someone hits a post or a ball doesn't quite cross the line. And then suddenly you're being critical of a team that you might otherwise have praised if that ball had gone into the goal.
Are we prophets of the past, in other words, is what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
I think you've got to be very careful not to do that. And that's why, you know, the Chelsea-Barcelona games, you say, look, Chelsea got it absolutely right. That was the best they could have done. And yet, at the same time, they were still lucky.
Michael?
I think tactics is kind of about maximising your chance of victory. It's not just about whether you win or not. I mean, if I got a team of Football Weekly regulars and got them to the Nou Camp and we lost 2-0, I think my tactics would probably have been quite good, really. Because,
what are you saying?
Because on natural ability, we should have lost 10-0. So I think a side can certainly lose and still have got their tactics right.
Right.
And a team can win and have got things dreadfully wrong.
It's a bit like playing poker. If you analyse the pot odds and make the right call, you can still lose the hand.
Well, that's true.
If your team has a 30% chance of winning and you transform that to a 35% chance of winning, as a coach, you've done a good job.
Fantastic. Now, Slim Pickens says, sorry, Jimbo, but is it time to stop discussing Syria with the continued scandals? It has the same relationship to football as Berlusconi does to politics.
I bet you tummed past the most important bit of that post.
I did not. It just lists some of the
stuff. It's
scandals.
Like on Seinfeld. Yadda, 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 the best bit.
Yeah, we're only a 45-minute show. We can't rumble through all the scandals, latest of which being that give us your shirts off your back scandal at the Marassi. Marco Rossi 7 says, re what happened at Genoa. I'm a season ticket holder and was there, as I have been all season. While I disagree with and don't condone what the minority of supporters did, I can understand their feeling, as this group of players, with only a few exceptions, don't deserve to wear our shirt or that of any team with the way they're playing. At the end of the season, most of them will be off, and in my opinion, non se ne frega un cazzo. Sorry if you speak Italian, that's a bit harsh. Finally, read the police. Outside the pub I was in before the game, there were two trucks full of polizia and one of Carabinieri, so I don't know where they were during the match. Possibly still outside the pub, I'm not sure. If I were a drug dealer, etc., the best place to do business would be in the stadiums, as there is virtually no control once you're inside. Well, all sorts of reaction to what happened.
The thing about that was the play set up to them. The reason he could sign up to them is because he's the grandson of a mafia don.
Well,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, his grandfather is alleged to be a top dog in the Ndrangheta down in Catania, who are a particularly efficient organisation. And that might well be. But he's a strong personality, Giuseppe Scully, in his own
right.
He
would be coming from a family like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's in his genes.
Yeah. Anyway, so it was a shocking spectacle. And Marco Rossi, thank you so much for getting in touch with that. Although I don't know, I can't ever see how you could justify that kind of behaviour and how the fans were allowed to do that and and then leave the stadium. As the Serbian papers are pointing out this week, and they printed pictures of when the Serbs disrupted the Euro qualifier there, and the extremely similar scenes on Sunday. They're saying, OK, here's the difference. These fans left and went home at the end of the game. Our lot ended up 8 months in prison. Why? And it is a question you have to ask. But not today, because we're going to move on very quickly just to finish off today's Foot Weekly Extra on the fact that there was, bizarrely, a midday round of games on Tuesday and Wednesday. Wednesday was Liberation Day in Italy, and they were able to fit in a midweek round of fixtures, which saw Juve beating Catania with the first goal from Borriello, actually. That's now 7 wins in a row. They are now 34 games unbeaten, and most importantly of all for them, they are 3 points clear still of AC Milan, who just about got a win against Genoa, who remain, the shirt-swapping people, who remain there 1 point above Lecce at the bottom of the table, because Lecce got beat by Napoli in what, Michael, we think is Napoli's first win since going out of the Champions League to Chelsea, when you talk about the effect that can have. In other news, Inter finally got a win. They're only 3 points off the top three now. That's crazy. And you saw Fiorentina springing another away surprise, Michael.
I did at Roma. They scored in, I think, the 91st minute through Lazzari, their second win over Roma this season, because they won 3-0 at home when Roma were down to 8 men, and Roma actually got a man sent off. Here it was Osvaldo against one of his former sides. Roma have a terrible disciplinary record this season.
Well, they do, don't they? And it does look like Luis Enrique won't be long for the Roma party. A lot of people making comments about how they should have kept Montella and that.
Have we got enough time? That is quite harsh if Enrique goes at the end of the season, isn't it?
Well, did you see the way that... I mean, I didn't see the Fiorentina game. You obviously saw that. I saw the game against Juventus, and I thought they were in utter shambles.
That is true. I didn't see that game.
They looked completely unfocused. It was supposedly one of their biggest games of the season. I mean, the Juve game is, alongside Lazio, one of the huge rivalries for Roma. Defensively, they were lined up in completely the wrong shape. There was no attempt to change things as Juve tore them apart. To be honest, there wasn't that much time, because Juve were, I think, two goals up inside the first 10 minutes. And the players just... this disciplinary thing doesn't speak well of their focus either. So I think there is a... well, certainly, I mean, not necessarily that I'm saying it, but in Rome they're saying, look, who is this Spanish fellow? And let's move on that.
But do you not think, having given him the licence to pretty much completely change the team from last season, yeah, is it not wise to stick with him a little bit more? Or would you not be left with a strange situation where another manager comes in and is left with a squad of players that just don't suit him?
Well, that's the question. Do you throw good time after bad, if you know what I'm saying? Do you lose more time on a project that clearly isn't going in the right direction, if you feel it clearly isn't going in the right direction, or do you think it is just a question of time? I think that the mood may be swinging in the capital, or probably was always heading a little bit that way. Well, the fans, I think, have always felt a little bit, from the early days when he benched Totti and that, hang on, this guy doesn't get Roma. The difference being that because the owners don't necessarily get what Roma represents to the fans, because they're Americans, they've come in, they've got a different game plan for success, that they maybe have given Enrique the benefit of the doubt. Whether they start changing their minds now is the big question. Barry, did you want to go?
No, I'm okay.
All right, okay. Well, it is time
to
go.
It's quite interesting that you say, you know, do you invest more time in a project that's going badly?
Are you talking about this
and
podcast?
Now you're about to end the podcast. Or should we continue for another 5 minutes?
Ah, dearie me.
That's pretty much the Chelsea situation, actually. Sorry, last point. That is the Chelsea situation. Luis Enrique was VS Boas. Right. Totti is John Terry.
Right.
Roma have kept on the same path. Chelsea have changed their manager. And
right. So what you're saying is Roma are exactly like Leeds in 1975. All right, it comes full circle. And with that, we come to the end of today's Football Weekly Extra. Many thanks to Barry Glendening, Michael Cox, of ZonalMarking.net. And when are you going to get your own website? I suppose you've got the Blizzard, have you, Jonathan?
I've got my own magazine. I don't need a website.
Yay.
www.theblizzard.co.uk. Anybody
very
wants
good.
To...
Note the way the Blizzard started as very much a co-op. Now it's my magazine.
Twas ever thus. And producer Ben Green, and you, the listener, many thanks. Have a super weekend. Speak to you all soon.